Well, that's beautiful, and no one for a moment would imagine that you're bowing a downpipe, well, strings stretched across a downpipe. John Rose, welcome back to the music show.
Thank you very much, Andy. Nice to see you here, although it's a little early.
And thank you for letting us into your museum. This is the Rosenberg Museum, and perhaps you could begin by telling us a little bit about what that is. This is the brainchild of Johannes Rosenberg, who is has a name very similar to yours, John Rose. And it's a museum that up until now has been mostly notional and virtual, but now we can touch things and knock things and smell things, and it's all real.
It's notional in Australia because it hasn't been back here since I moved to Berlin in 1985. But it actually, as you can see, it's real objects. Sometimes the story around the object has been changed. Sometimes the story is incredibly real and the object is made to fit the story. So it does work on this border between, if you like, reality, and I'd like to use the word fantasy. So reality and fantasy, they're all real as far as I'm concerned. But the Rosenberg family itself is like, I thought, well, I'm just a musician. I can't handle all this stuff that these people are supposed to do. So there was a Johannes Rosenberg, who's the famous composer, of course. He's dead, of course, because if you're a famous composer, you have to be dead. And he's been dead for 20 years. I did musicology, has an amazing CV, you know, first to give violin lessons to the Beatles, first to climb Mount Everest, his music sent off to outer space, all this kind of stuff. Then there's Joe Doc Rosenberg, famous legendary bebop violinist. There's Jimmy Rosenberg, who was a country and western star, moved to East Germany, became a heavy metal violinist and committed suicide. So it goes on. There's like it's an endless list of whoever you want to be a Rosenberg can be.
And without wishing to sort of have you explain a joke, which is sort of what it would come down to, I mean, you're a violinist yourself. I mean, a real violinist. You actually can play the violin. You are a composer. You make music. And some people who play the violin and compose would be content with those things. But you're, in a sense, holding the violin up to endless scrutiny, aren't you?
There are two major stories that happened in my life which probably account for this. I mean, you can see that in retrospect. When you start to play the violin, it's an incredibly difficult instrument, as most people know. No matter how good you become on it, the first year is murder for everybody concerned. And I wasn't going quite fast enough, and so I actually tried to smash the violin over the kitchen table when I was 7 years old. It fell apart on the way down to the table because it was a school violin. It wasn't very well made, and it just the glue had come unstuck. My dad, who was very good with his hands, stuck it back overnight. But the reality was that when I saw the violin, it was 70 pieces of wood. I thought it had come down from heaven, that they arrived looking like that, you know, with these beautiful Baroque skulls and the fantastic sort of varnish finish, and probably accompanied by angels blowing trumpets, you know. And so the reality, it was a shock. My God, someone just made this, you know. The other thing that happened in the 70s, when the oil crisis was on, there was a lot of money in London, and there was a lot of Islamic exhibitions and museums and shows and concerts, and I went to one on music, and what was disturbing about it was that all the instruments collected in this museum had been collected that year and had just been made, and amongst them were fantastically ornate scrolls, beautiful things attached to sound resonators, which might be a gasoline can, a Coca-Cola bottle, a wooden box. In other words, it was a viable experimental tradition. And that blew my mind, because I was being, you know, having this severe classical training, which was saying, this is the music, that's the instrument, this is how you do it. See you in, you know, when you retire, which will be soon, because you can't do it for very long on the violin, because it's like it's killer to your back and everything else, you know. So it being the kind of character I am, I thought, well, there is these other things. I'm not getting the whole story here. And the more you start to look at the violin tradition, which has, you know, even the most hardcore, you know, conservative violinist will admit is a fairly atrophied tradition, there's another world going on. And so I set about discovering this other world and having it influence my world. So the first thing I realized, well, you could buy a whole bunch of cheap violins and turn them into whatever you want and have them played, have the strings excited by any mechanism, not just bow, other kinds of mechanisms.
And well, let's have a look at this one behind you. We've got now a violin which is, what's that violin actually made of? It's silver.
It's just been painted. This is my kind of mock Industrial Revolution little thing here. That's actually one of those violins which is It has an amazingly good sound. It costs $80. It's Chinese violins used to be a joke. Now they make perfectly good Chinese students. That comes with its own box, includes postage, spare set of strings, bow. It doesn't have an instruction manual. That's the only thing missing. $80. You can't get a decent set of violin strings for $80.
So violins don't come from heaven anymore. They come from Shanghai.
They absolutely do. And, you know, there are 2 million of Chinese violinists, I think. You know.
So this is a bowing machine.
I've made an upsize with my friend Harry Vitiliotis, who's a great violin maker in Sydney. But I've made a kind of upsized version of the thing I had in 1989 in Berlin, which was 4 bowing machines. And so you might think, well, why would you bother to do a bowing machine when you can bow it? Well, no human can actually bow it like that because you're not a machine. So I'm interested in this kind of gestalt between what happens between mechanical things, what happens between digital technology, and what real people do. And that keeps me interested. This, you know, and also there's a lot of things in this, in the museum, which are what I call provisional musical experiments. If I do this to this and do it, what happens? Like over that one over there, you can just see in the corner, there's a violin underneath a huge PVC pipe. And if you drop lots of ping pong balls on that, that violin is going to play. I haven't done it yet, but we'll find out probably when we do.
But I mean, the influence of Percy Grainger, it seems to me to hover behind what you're doing, particularly in the provisional side of things, because he was also somebody who invented instruments. And yet there's sort of, they don't really function, partly because they would fall apart, but also because there's nothing for them to do.
Well, you've come to the point, what is a musical instrument? You know, I mean, I can play anything. That is music. It's got rhythm, it's got timbre, and it's got pitch. So that's basically, there's nothing else that's in music except maybe you can say structure. Well, I stopped when I started, so there's your structure. So anything can be music. It's the context, it's what we want from it, it's what its meaning becomes, it's all these other things, but which are basically arbitrarily added to what we decide music is. And, you know, my grandmother, who was stone deaf, used to go and put her radio on, like, so the thing was distorted. It wasn't tuned to any channel. And it was just this horrendous row coming. And she'd go and, I'm going to put on a little bit of noise, dear. And she'd drop off to sleep to this. And I knew she didn't like anything except maybe Mantovani, you know. So it didn't matter to her. So music can be anything.
Now, when you say you've got machines playing these instruments, but you've also got people playing the instruments, but they don't know that they're playing them. And there's a piano over here that's being played by gamblers. So that rather delicate music is the sound of people losing their money in Las Vegas.
More than that, it's the sound of extremely poor people losing the last of their money in Las Vegas. This is recorded, an audio recording of one of the big casinos there, and there would have been 200 people in a room frantically putting the last of their money into machines, poker machines. Oddly enough, I discovered they're all in C major. It's just kind of... And this particular version has been filtered. I can play you... Actually, I can just find another version of it where it's not filtered and it's going hell for leather. It sounds like a cross between Nan Caro and a great blues piano player playing in C.
So. When you say it's filtered...
Well, it's filtered. You can actually filter the amount of sound that's being translated from audio into MIDI. So this is like almost the bare bones of what that program, that software is picking up from this mayhem.
If we hear the piano actually representing the mayhem...
If you listen to that for a while, you can really start to hear C major coming, and all the other notes that are not in the key of C are all people shouting and screaming and money pouring out of the slot machine. The other end of that extreme of extremely poor people losing the last of their money are extremely wealthy people basically screwing the rest of the planet. So this is Wall Street. This is what we've got in front of us, is a Data violin. So this is it's a regular violin.
It's big.
Actually, it's a viola, yes, but I just call everything a violin. It just saves time. except double basses. They're not violins. So each of these, the fingers, if you like, represent Apple, Macintosh, BP, Petroleum, Morgan Stanley, banks. I mean, basically 26 of the biggest traders on Wall Street. And as they trade online, you basically, as you probably know now, most people know that pretty well anything can, which produces data can be changed into other kinds of data and reused. So that data is converted into MIDI, which is sort of an international protocol for digital music, and it plays. So basically this trading is playing this machine. It's normally done live. There are no traders at the moment. They're all asleep. So this is a recording from last year. We've queued it a little bit, so there's some gaps. But basically, when you get a long note, it means there are billions of dollars are going down the plug hole as we're listening. That's a big, that's a lot of money going down the plug hole right there.
Wow. They were being quite cautious up until that point. Suddenly, flurry of activity.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
So this was, I mean, at random. This is the remains of a project. Like most things that, you know, real life is always much more extraordinary than make-believe life. So this is the remains of a violin that was blown up, and it's based on a true story. A street violinist in London, Ontario, in Canada, wanted to go for an interview for a job. So he put his violin in the left luggage of a Greyhound station, spruced himself up, and off he went for his interview. The guy running the Greyhound station thought, this guy looks a bit seedy, you know, wrong color or something. So I called the police, and the police came, took his violin out in the street and blew it up. So we reenacted this in Paris in 2002 for the exhibition there, and this is the remains of that violin.
Let's go and look. How many artifacts do you actually have in the Rosenberg Museum?
Well, every time we try to do a catalogue, it never gets finished. The last catalogue we attempted in Berlin, there were over 800, and I think there must be over 1,000 now.
And these objects vary from incredibly beautiful and indeed valuable through to utter tat.
More than tat. I mean,
less than tat.
Can you get more out and wacky and extreme and distasteful than that? Right next to this extraordinary guy, Karl Unten, who, as you see, had no arms. And he said his the midwife wanted to strangle him at birth, suffocate him rather at birth. He turned out to be an extraordinary violinist. He's playing, as you see, with his two feet. And he worked for Richard Strauss. He worked in front of the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra. He was, apart from being in that period of the music hall freak show period, which of course he made money out of. He was played in front of classical orchestras, and he obviously could play. There's no recording of him, but he's written his own autobiography, which is on another shelf.
Say his name again.
Karl Unten. And he had a stage name, like Satori. That was his stage name.
Okay.
Satori. Down here. These are the conjoined sisters, Blatzek sisters. I mean, so they are conjoined twins. And this is where it gets interesting. So I made a violin, a double violin, over on the other side. And then the guy ran the museum, Joseph Cherish, he found this whole story about these Slovakian conjoined twins who were big time on the music hall. And of course, they're playing violin duos. So I'd actually sort of inadvertently made a violin which would have been perfect for a pair of conjoined twins.
And this post... Well, it's a photograph of it's the word violin with an accent on the second I.
Right. Well, this is where it gets totally out, because the reason Joseph became the director of the museum for two decades...
When you say Joseph, you...
Joseph Cherish, he was the director. He resigned, basically because we couldn't pay him any money. Obviously, I think he'd had enough of violins. He discovered... He was in a car with Phil Niblock, a minimalist New York composer, and they looked up, and there was a sign. It said violin, spelt violin, in the middle of Slovakia. And... So Joseph thought, well, we should put the museum there.
It's the name of the place.
Yes, it's the name of the place. This is a photograph of the station. It's got a railway station, and that's the waiting room.
And does it mean violin in Slovakian?
It doesn't. It doesn't mean anything. It just means the name violin. Violin in Slovakian is fusel. Anyway, so the story is insane. It was owned by Count Violini. He gambled the town at the beginning of the 20th, end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. He lost it in the card game. It was owned by the bank for 50 years. The town was flooded wildly by the Danube in the 1950s. It was basically almost washed away. It's now sort of inhabited by about 80 fairly alcoholic Slovakians, and they live in a Hungarian enclave. That means they don't understand anybody in the village next to them. So it's all a kind of a crazy place. Anyway, Joseph persuaded the mayor to give us the football club to be the Rosenberg Museum. And we said, it'll be a violin museum. And the mayor probably thought, wow, we can get some tourism money out of this, you know. So he turned up with his wife, all dressed up, for the opening night. And instead of walking into, you know, quartets by Haydn or whatever it was he was expecting, the first thing he saw as he came in was Ben Patterson, who's a Fluxus artist, sawing up a violin case, putting it in a blender and making marmalade. That's just the first thing he saw. So shortly after that, Joseph and these good citizens of violin sort of fell out, and they actually threatened his life if he moved. So we mayors change though every so often. So we are invited back every few years to do a new piece of violin history right in front of them.
I think you'll be much safer here at Carriage Works.
Well, actually, yes, definitely safer here. And also, of course, they close the station like everywhere, you know.
So you can't get to violin anymore.
You can drive there, but it really is in the deepest, darkest central parts of Europe.
John, thank you very much for giving us a guided tour of at least a little bit of the Rosenberg Museum. We've only scratched the surface, but people who are able to come to Carriage Works in Sydney over the next week should do so, because there is a lot to explore here and almost everything has got a story attached to it, and most of the stories are pretty extraordinary. Thanks, John.
Andy, you're welcome. Thank you.
The museum goes live at Carriage Works until Sunday, the 6th of November. And there are performances associated with this exhibition, I should say. Ensemble Offspring have been taking part in them to date, and their last one is tonight at 6:30. And then, starting on Wednesday, there are further performances with a rather stellar lineup of experimental musicians of all sorts of hue. So do go along if you're in anywhere near the Everleigh Railway Yards in Sydney. Carriage Works is the place to go.